This is my first time with a clicker here, so I just want to make sure I get it. Let's see. Is that the end? Nope. Back. There we go. Good morning. It's excellent to be here. As Andrew said, my name's Adam, my wife, and she would love to be here today. My youngest son woke up with the flu or something this morning, so she couldn't be here, but she did want to be here. To be here with you today. It was excellent time yesterday that we had talking about what it means to be people who proclaim the gospel, proclaim the good news of God's kingdom into people's lives. And it's always energizing to me to do these sessions because every time I sit with a group of Christians and we have that conversation, I'm always learning as we go along. And it's always, to me, evidence of the way that God uses the body together to be a part of encouraging each other, building us up, and equipping each other for that. So in any case, we had a great time yesterday. And this morning, what I want us to do is I want us to think about this passage and how you saw that the title of this is an answer and an invitation. But I haven't told you what the question is yet. So let me tell you what the question is. As Andrew said, a year ago, we moved from Brooklyn, New York, back here to the Midwest. I live in northern Indiana. And when we moved back, we didn't have a house to live in, and we hadn't found a rental place or anything like that. And some friends of ours who lived in the area let us move into their basement. And so their basement was big, but there were no rooms or anything. It was just one giant open space. And so my family of four moved into the basement of a house of another family of four. And if you want to come up close and personal with your own sort of brokenness, you should do that. Move into somebody else's basement. And do so with the intention for staying for 2 weeks and stay for 3 months. Because that's a good way to do it. So no, anyways, after we had been there a couple of weeks, we thought to ourselves, we need to buy a house, like in a hurry. And we found a house that we ended up buying and almost exactly 1 year ago moved into. And this was our first house that we purchased. We'd lived in parsonages and apartments and whatnot before this. So this was ours. And what was exciting to me about that was that home ownership took on this whole new level of excitement for me because this was mine, you know? My sons and I love to watch this old house and all the home remodeling projects and all of that. We were geeked to think that we have our own space now, that we can do some of these remodeling projects, we can work on our house and fix it up the way that we wanted to. And I love to do that. I love to, you know, get out and work in the yard, although I like it more now that it's my own house than when I was doing it when I was a kid and my dad was making me do it. But I really very rapidly sort of fell in love with the idea that this space is mine in the world, right? I'm living in my house. This doesn't belong to anybody else, right? I don't have a landlord. I mean, technically it belongs to the bank, but I tell myself that it's mine, you know? It's mine. It's my space. So I was really excited to have my own little space, you know, kind of like my own little kingdom. You know, this is Adam's. What I realized though is that it's not all perfect, because to live in a neighborhood means you have neighbors, and they don't always act like I think they should act. Across the street, I've got these two teenage neighbors of mine, and their parents are never there. I can't figure out what's going on. It's just like these two teenage kids living in this house. And I've seen their dad like twice in the year that I've lived there. So I really can't figure out what's going on. But nonetheless, they smoke pot and drink profusely with their friends in the garage and swear like at the top of their lungs all the time. They're right next to each other. I don't have to shout all these profanities, but they're just shouting them crazily. And in the hot summer, we've got our windows open and my son's room is on the front of the house, so not 100 feet from where these bozos are doing drugs, drinking like crazy, and swearing like crazy. And like immediately, I'm mad. And I don't know if you've ever felt this before. Immediately, I'm mad. And I'm just like, what are these jokers doing? You know, what are they doing here? Why do they even live here? Right? They're encroaching on my turf. Right? No, they don't ever come in my yard, but they're encroaching on my turf, and they're sort of impeding the life that I want, particularly if my kids start dropping the F-bomb, right? Because they do. So it's making me mad, and I find myself being like, man, life would be so much easier if they're just gone. Just out of here. There's another thing that I found that frustrates me too. Almost all of the houses in my little section of the neighborhood have contracted with a lawn mowing service to mow the lawns. And of course, this lawn mowing service, they're doing like 30 lawns a day in our neighborhood. And so their goal is to get it done as quickly as possible, right? So anytime you try to do something super fast, you're bound to not do something right. And so there have been a few things that have fully annoyed me. The first is, at the beginning of the year when they came out with their fertilizing treatments, they were driving these big trucks around that was dropping and spraying fertilizer everywhere, but one of them was leaking oil. And this guy was driving around indiscriminately and decided to just drive right over my driveway to get to the neighbor's house, because both neighbors on both sides of me contract with them. So he just drives right through my lawn. So he leaves tire tracks in my lawn and then this big oil spill right across my driveway. And I cannot get it up. I can't get it up. Now they start mowing. And they bring out these tractors with like 60-inch decks, right, with the zero turning radius and all of this. And they are flying. My neighborhood has really small yards. With a 60-inch deck, you maybe 2.5 times you'd get every yard, right? Maybe, and they'd be done, right? Now, the problem is that there's like 8 feet, I haven't measured it, but it's like 8 feet between my house and my neighbor's house. So you imagine, right, when they take a 60-inch deck and they drive in between my neighbor's house and my house, they basically mow my yard at the same time, right? Which on the one hand means less work for me, but on the other, it means that it looks ugly all the time. It does this because they're following the landscaping of my neighbor's yard, so my yard looks like that. And what's worse is the side discharge of the grass throws grass all over the side of my house. You can imagine 60 inches worth of grass that gets blown all over the side of my house, right into my air conditioner, and I go out there and I'm like, what am I supposed to do with this? Right? And I feel very frustrated. And, you know, my neighbor, what I found is that I'm frustrated with her. Right? She's not mowing her lawn. She's 90. She walks around the block once a day. She's 90. It's not her, but I'm feeling very frustrated with her. So I say that to tell you this story. It's not my finest moment. I'm mowing my lawn. And it was like the same day or the day after they had just mowed. And so all of that frustration is bubbling up in me. And I'm feeling to myself, like, I'm mowing, and I'm like, good grief, I can't believe this. Like, this is ridiculous. Wish that, you know, all these people would just go away. It's annoying me. So I'm mowing, and I'm like, all right, I've got it. Here's my chance. I'm going to get back at my neighbor. And I get to the edge of the lawn, and I do this. I push the mower down so that it just throws my grass clippings all over hers. Take that. It felt really good in the moment, and then as I'm walking backwards, I think, well, that was kind of dumb. That was kind of dumb. I mean, this little old lady didn't deserve that. What an idiot. As I continued to mow my lawn that day, I felt like I was getting a very up-close and personal window into just how me-centered I can be, right? Here I am trying to exact some sense of revenge on a little old lady who has nothing to do with my frustration. And yet all of my actions are just based on this idea that my life would be easier if none of my neighbors lived next to me. Right? Find myself asking that question, like, why are these people even here? Why are these people even here? And that frustration is sort of magnified when I feel like all of the people that are around me are impinging on my kingdom vision, right? I want to protect my space. I want to protect my kids. I want to protect my yard. I want to put up a fence, really, is what I want to do. But I can't afford a fence, and so I just feel frustrated all the time. As I was mowing, I was then reflecting on, maybe that's not the only place that I have a kind of kingdom vision for my life, but it's my own, you know? It's not just my house and my yard, but it's also like the job that I have and how much money I make so that I can afford to do the things that I feel like I ought to be able to do with my life. Sometimes, I find myself frustrated when my life doesn't meet my own vision. I don't know if you've ever felt that before. When other people infringe and interrupt and are an obstacle to the kind of life I want, right? I see them as sort of enemies for the kingdom of Adam. And I find myself asking the question, why are these people even here? Because, man, it would be so much easier if they would be gone. I don't know if you can resonate with that or not. I mean, maybe, hopefully, you're not like me and you're not blowing grass clippings all over your elderly neighbor's lawn. But I don't know if you've ever felt something similar to that. Like, maybe you feel like you bring a lot to the table at your job, but you keep getting passed over for other people who've just played political games. Right? Or maybe you wish that your spouse would do things differently in your marriage because they're not sort of meeting your vision of what that should look like. Right? Maybe your kids aren't behaving or achieving the way that you think they should. Or maybe you're like me and you have a neighbor who keeps cutting your grass. Right? Life would be so much easier if those people out there getting in my way maybe either did things differently or they weren't around. Why are these people even here? And I feel that when people start to infringe, I've got to protect this. So, that's the question. What are all these people doing here? Right? Into a world that are full of people asking the question, why are they here? Because life would be so much easier if these people were not around. Our text today offers us an answer and an invitation. Our text answers that question, why are these people here? And when it does that, it invites us into a new way of living. One that's not, if I could put it this way, hell-bent on protecting our own personal kingdoms, but it invites us into a way of living as the channel through which God extends his kingdom. That's what this text does for us this morning. So let's go ahead and look at this here. Andrew read this for us. And so what we've got here in this passage is Paul going to the city of Athens. Athens is a cosmopolitan city. It's a progressive city. And it's got all of this philosophy, the latest ideas, very similar to big mega cities today. They're sort of the epicenter of progressive thought and ideas and philosophy, and all that sort of radiates out from that. Well, that's what Athens is, right? And so you might imagine Paul, I don't know if we really sort of sat down in this story, like he goes into this town and he starts talking with people and people start making fun of him, right? They're calling him a babbler. What was this idiot talking about, right? Is basically it. And he does all of this work. He sees all of this idol worship. He's frustrated by what he's looking at. People are making fun of him. Most people are rejecting him. He goes through this whole process. And here in the second part of this, or third part, that was back here a little bit. This is the only time I'm going to come here, but it says some of the people, right? And it names two people and says, and some others, and a few others. Paul goes through all of this work for maybe five converts. I don't know if you're like me, I feel like I'm looking at Paul thinking, boy, he might be thinking the same thing I'm thinking. What are these people even doing here? Right? If these people weren't here, right, all these philosophers with their ideas and all of this, boy, my ministry would be so much easier. Right? I don't know about you, but I feel like I would concede that to Paul when he walks around and people just want to argue with him. Right? I don't know if as a Christian you've ever felt this before. Right? The same kind of thing that Paul is. Like, you walk out into the world and you're like, man, what are these people doing? There's all of this idolatry and all these crazy philosophies that have nothing to do with what I believe. And what's more, all the people that believe all those things make fun of me for it, right? They don't call me a babbler, but they probably call me an idiot, naive, right? Making our life hard to be a Christian is a pretty common way of feeling in the world, I think. I don't know if you've ever felt that, where as a Christian you're saying, boy, it would be so much easier to be a Christian if all these non-Christians weren't around. I mean, I've felt that. I don't know if you have. Life would be so much easier if it wasn't here. So I think we could excuse Paul if he felt that way, because I think it's natural. I think it's human. But he doesn't. And in fact, Paul doesn't even ask the question, what are these people doing here? And he doesn't ask the question because he already knows the answer. So after he spent this time talking with all of these Athenian people, they invite him to come to this place called Mars Hill, where all these philosophers would sit and talk about, I love this verse, verse 21, all the Athenians did nothing but sit around and talk about the latest ideas. So they invite Paul to share some of his ideas. And watch here in this passage, this is what he preaches, which shows us he doesn't ask the question because he already knows the answer. So Paul stands up and he says, I see that you're very religious. I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship. I've even found an altar with the inscription to an unknown God. So you're ignorant of the very thing that you're worshiping. And that's who I'm going to proclaim to you today. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. He doesn't live in temple built by human hands. And he's not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives life and breath and everything else to everyone. From one man he made all the nations that they would inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. And he did this so that they would seek him and find him and perhaps reach out to him, though he's not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Did you hear the answer to the question, why are these people here? Did you hear it? It's right there in verses 26 and 27. God marked out the appointed times in history and the boundaries of people's lands. And he did it so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him. But he's not far from any one of us. Let me put that in another way. Why are these people here? God puts people when and where they are so that they will find him. God puts people when and where they are so that they would know him. Paul doesn't ask the question because he knows the answer. What an incredible way to walk through the world. This is challenging to me. What an incredible way to walk through the world where Paul sees people not as an obstacle to the pursuit and achievement of his own goals, but as people who are squarely in the middle of God's desire for them to encounter him. God has, from the beginning of time, marked out when and where people would live because he wants them to meet him. He wants them to meet him. And this challenges the way that I live naturally in my neighborhood, doesn't it? I mean, at least it should change everything. Because now the kids are smoking pot across the street, and the neighbors who hire the lawn mowing company that blows grass clippings all over my lawn, they are not impediments to me living comfortably. They're the object of God's pursuit. As I think about it, these verses totally invalidate that question. Why are these people even here? Because of the spirit in which it is asked. That idea that my life would be so much easier if these people weren't around. It would be so much easier to be a Christian if these non-Christians weren't around. That spirit is invalidated by the reality that God has put all of those people where they are because he passionately wants to know them and wants them to know him. God desires an encounter with those people. And as I've sat and reflected on this passage, on this sermon by Paul, I think if we were to run this sermon across our own hearts, it would reveal the character of our hearts. Right? Because in this passage, the character of God is revealed to be passionately pro-neighbor. Passionately pro-neighbor. And I just want to call the cops on him. So before we move on to the invitation, I want us to think about this answer. The answer to that question, why are these people even here? Right? God puts people when and where they are so that they would encounter him. And I guess I would just ask you to ask yourself or to ask God to show you. God, what is this saying to me? What does this reveal to me about the way that I walk through the world? How do I see people as impediments and obstacles to my own kingdom goals or as the object of the pursuit of your kingdom? How do I see people? Well, actually, take a second and think about that. So not only does it answer that question, but it invites us into a new way of living. Right? Doesn't just answer the question for us. This passage, I think, invites us into a new way of living where we are not so focused on our own kingdoms, but we want to live as the channel through which God extends his kingdom. And to get at this, I want to share a little bit of the backstory of this passage because I think it will be helpful for us to really understand the way that God works. So about 500 years before Paul shows up in Athens, Athens was going through a terrible plague. And the reason we know this is because there were historians back then, the same way there are historians today, and there was a historian about this time when Paul was actually there named Diogenes Laertius. I actually had to practice saying that. Diogenes Laertius, that's the last time I'm going to say it. And he was a historian around the first century, and he wrote a lot about this Athenian plague. And it was 500 years before, and of course there's all this religion and all this philosophical stuff going on, and all of the sort of religious leaders of Athens at the time came up with all different ways that they could try to appease the gods to relieve them of the plague. And no matter what they tried, the plague continued to get worse. And this plague was ravaging the city of Athens about 500 BC or so. There was no answer to it. So what the historian tells us is that these Athenian leaders realized that they had no answers. But they had heard of a man who lived on the island of Crete named Epimenides. And Epimenides was known to be a very wise religious leader, and they thought maybe he will have some answers. So they travel to Crete. They tell Epimenides what's going on. He comes back to Athens with them. And as he takes stock of the situation, he says, okay, well, it seems to me we've got basically one choice. We have to, first of all, we have to assume that we have missed a god, right? We've missed a god here somewhere because if we hadn't, this plague would be gone. There's a god that we've forgotten about or don't know about. The second thing is we have to assume that that god's actually big enough to handle this situation, that he can actually save the city from its own destruction. And the third thing we have to assume is that if that God exists, and he really is big enough, that he would also be big enough to forgive us for the fact that we don't know who he is, right? So what they do is they set up an altar to the God they don't know, and they say to him, we realize that you exist and we didn't know it until now. We also want to believe that you're big enough to save us from this horrible plague, but also at the same time, would you forgive us for not knowing you until now? Okay? And they sacrifice, they make a sacrifice to this God on an altar. And like that, the historian Diogenes tells us that the plague was immediately lifted. And so the people of Athens created a permanent altar to the God they don't know. Paul, walking around, sees the altar to the unknown God. And, you know, we have in Washington, D.C., the tomb of the unknown soldier, right? which is a memorial to all soldiers that we don't know who we've lost. And in that sense, it represents all unknown fallen soldiers. So there's a way of reading this that makes it seem like this might be a catch-all altar. That's not it at all. This is not a catch-all altar, making sure that we've gotten all the gods. This is an altar very specifically set up for the one God that we didn't know who saved us from the plague we couldn't save ourselves from. Okay? So Paul says, I'm looking around and I see all these things, and there's an altar to a God you don't know over there. Let me tell you who that God is. Pretty cool, right? Pretty cool. 500 years before Paul shows up, the God of heaven and earth does an incredible saving work and demonstrates incredible mercy on this total pagan town. And 500 years later, that God brings Paul in to make the introduction. Let me introduce you to the God you don't know who saves you and has mercy on you. There's no reason for us to believe that Paul knew that story before he came in. But Paul was invited to participate. Paul became a channel through which God extended his kingdom in this very pagan place of Athens. You see, God has put people when and where they are so that they will find him. But also, God puts us when and where we are so that we can help make that introduction. Right? If God has all those people right where he wants them because he wants them to encounter him, he's got us right where he wants us so that we can help make that introduction. You've played that game perhaps in the pool as a kid, Marco Polo, where you're just searching out for the other person. God's not interested in playing that game with people. He wants them to know him. He wants them to find him. He is not far from any of us. And yet people still are playing Marco Polo. But God puts his people where they are to be the people who make that divine introduction. To be the people that make that divine introduction. Right? So there's the invitation. The invitation is out of our kingdoms and into God's for the sake of the people who live next to us, sit at the cubicle next to us, share meals around our table. You get the point. We are invited out of our kingdom and into God's. Right? And when we accept that, to stop trying to protect my own space, but live life seeking to be a channel through which God extends his reign in the world, it can change everything. And I want us to read, actually, this passage again and see that that's what Paul's been doing from the very beginning. Right? It says he was distressed to see all this idol worship, but that doesn't make him mad. It actually creates passion. He goes deeper into the city. He starts reasoning with people in the synagogue. He goes out into the marketplace to meet people and understand where they're at. He's paying attention for invitations from God, which is, frankly, what the invitation to come and speak at Mars Hill has to be. You've got all these people who are very hard-hearted, and yet they're saying to Paul, no, hey, come talk to us. We want to hear more about this. Right? Paul has got this sort of expectation and anticipation that if he is watching, there will be opportunities, invitations from God to be someone who makes that introduction. To help people encounter the God who has always been there. Right? Paul says in the sermon, God is never far from any of us. Like he was here 500 years ago. And he's here right now. He has always, always been here. I'm always amazed. This last verse says, as some of your poets have said, we are his offspring. You know who that poet was? Epimenides. I'm always amazed at how God seems to be orchestrating this behind the scenes. That Paul is even quoting the poet who called the people to repent and believe in the God they didn't know. What an unbelievable story. So when I wake up in the morning, I have a choice. Right? I have a choice every day. I can be about my kingdom and the frustrations that I feel when people impinge on it. Or I can be about God's kingdom, waiting and watching for those opportunities to be a part of people encountering him. I mean, most days, I'm not crazy about my job, right? I have to have a job just like everybody else to pay the bills. This is something I do on the weekends and the evenings and when I can fit it in. The hours are bad. It's sometimes very tedious. People get angry at me all the time, you know, customers and the job that I have, right? My coworkers are so incredibly far from God, right? I'm constantly faced with the struggle of being like, why are these people even here? Right? People become an obstacle to me when I've got my own stuff in my field of vision. But I can surrender my kingdom. That's the choice I have, to surrender my own kingdom pursuit and align myself with God's. Right? And, you know, that sounds great. How do you do that? I mean, to me, the only thing that I did different was that on the way to work, which I have about a 25-minute drive to work, on the way to work, I started praying to myself, well, to God, but, you know, not out loud. God, help me to be paying attention to what you're doing in other people's lives today, and help me to care more about that than my own stuff. Right? This mess that I sort of find myself in. Help me to care more about what you're doing in other people's lives today than my own stuff. I've prayed that, and I just have it on repeat. And when I do that, I find that it helps me emulate Paul with that sort of anticipation that God might be at work. Right? When I go into my office, I have an anticipation now that God might be up to something that I didn't see beforehand. When I don't pray that prayer, I'm thinking about how fast can I get out of here and get on to what I want to do. Right? It helps me work out that belief that God put the people that I work next to where they are so that they can encounter him, and that if I'm paying attention, he might invite me to help them make that encounter. So when I'm standing on the middle of a sales floor on a busy Saturday, and one of my coworkers comes up to me and she says, my husband came home last night and he told me that he's leaving me and he wants a divorce. And I've started, as I listen to him talk about why it is he wants to leave me, I realize that I've been incredibly selfish over the last 10 years. And I'm like face to face with my own brokenness, and that hurts. Direct quote. Is that an interruption? Is that an obstacle? Or is that an invitation from God to be a part of what he's doing in somebody else's life? The choice is totally up to me in that moment to receive that as an interruption to my day, a nuisance that keeps me from performing my job tasks, or to see this as the larger thing that God is doing. He's doing more here than I can know, the same way that he was doing more in that moment than Paul could have known. The poet Elizabeth Barrett Browning has this great line where she says, earth is crammed with heaven, and every common bush is afire with God. But only those who have the eyes to see take off their shoes. The rest sit around and eat blackberries. She's, of course, referencing Moses, you know. When he encounters God in the wilderness and the bush is burning, and because that's like he is encountering God, he takes off his sandals. This is a holy ground moment. When I'm praying prayers like this, I'm realizing that I should just go to work barefoot in preparation. Just in preparation. I wish I had time to tell you more stories, because it happens constantly when I am paying attention. When I'm saying to God, I want to live part of your kingdom, not mine today. I should just take my shoes off. Because they're all burning bush moments. The reality is, most days, I'm eating blackberries. Right? So here's what I would want to say, I guess, to you this morning, is that I think that same choice is available to all of us every day. I'm going to wake up today, I'm going to be about my kingdom and my stuff and my agenda, or I'm going to be about what God is doing and recognizing that people are not an obstacle to me achieving my kingdom goals, but people are when and where they are because God wants to know them and that he might want to use me in that. We all have that choice. And if I could have told you more and more stories, I guess I would just sum it up by saying this. When we choose this here to be a part of God's kingdom, we get the opportunity to live our entire life in the arena of God's activity. Think what we will realize is that we live our entire lives in the arena of God's activity. But only those who have eyes to see take off their shoes. So a lot of blackberry eating happening while God is working. But the invitation is there. Let's pray. Lord, I admit that most days when I wake up, I'm thinking about how tired I am, or how busy I am, or how loud my kids are. And in the bigger sense, how I wish that I was making more money, or had a car that had air conditioning, or whatever. God, it is so clear to me that most days I'm still aligned with my own stuff. I don't know if that's all of us or not, but God, we want to pray this morning that we would be people who know how to sort of turn from, repent from our own kingdom pursuits and align our life with the pursuit of your kingdom. That we would be people, as Jesus said, that we would seek first. We would pursue above anything else your kingdom and your righteousness. Not just so that all the other things would be added unto us, but recognizing that that is where you want us to live, in the arena of your activity. Help us to be wide-eyed, eager, and anticipating the opportunities to step into conversations and relationships with people whom you have died to meet and for whom you've risen to give new life. Amen.
Let's stand together. And we'll sing this song to the God who is always active. And may this song be on our lips as we go from this place, seeing every bush aflame with the presence of God. For truly, it is holy ground. Let's sing.
Bless the Lord, O my soul, O my soul. Worship his holy name. Sing like never before, O my soul. I'll worship your holy name. Comes up, it's a new day dawning. It's time to sing your song again. Whatever may pass and whatever lies before me, let me be singing when the evening. bless the Lord, oh my soul. Oh my soul, worship his holy name. Sing like never before. Oh my soul, I worship your holy name. Rich in love and you're slow to anger. Your name is great and your heart is kind. For all your goodness I will keep on singing. 10,000 reasons for my heart to find. Bless the Lord, oh my soul. Oh my soul, worship his holy name. Sing like never before. Strength is failing, the end draws near, and my time has come. Still, my soul will sing your praise unending. 10,000 years and then forevermore. Bless the Lord, oh my soul. Worship his holy name. Sing like never before. Oh my soul, I worship your holy name. Bless the Lord, oh my soul. Oh my soul, worship his holy name. Like never before. Oh my soul, I worship your holy name. I worship your holy name. Yes, I worship your holy name.